Welcome back. I'm Jay from Windows Azure Storage.
And I'm Andrew Edwards from the Windows Azure Storage team as well.
Yeah. So we went, just to summarize what we covered at this point, we went over Windows Azure Storage, the infrastructure, the architecture as such. We went over the geo-replication. We went over some of the authentication schemes and best practices. And then, of course, we also kind of looked at the looked at a demo of read-only, how you can get this read-only access to your secondary and get higher availability. The source code for all the demos and everything will be placed. The links will be up on our blog site. So if you just search for Windows Azure Storage Team blog, you should get that. It's usually the first link. So it's out there. We'll put it out there in our next week or two. Just has to go through LCA and all that stuff before we can put any source code out. So anyways, getting back to what we have today, best practices. And so we'll start with a kind of general .NET best practices for Windows Azure storage, but it's in general, it has hit a lot of customers who are not even on Azure, and it's just some nuances that you need to take care of when you're using .NET. Scalability targets, it's a very important piece of information that almost every Windows Azure application developer should know if they're using storage. General Windows Azure storage best practices, and then we will go into blobs, tables, and queues. So to go over the .NET best practice, disable nagling for small messages because it's just going to create delayed ACK as such, especially if it is less than 1,400 bytes. There are a lot of times where we get these requests that my queue message or my table is very slow while inserting, and what should I do? And almost always it gets to basically disabling nagling as such so that you don't have this delayed ACK problem out there. Disable expect 100 continue. And this has an asterisk against it because you need to disable it if you're confident that all your authentication is going through. However, if you're writing an Explorer, if you have an option where the user may not give you the right creds, especially when you're using shared access signature, you can turn it on because expect 100 continue is going to save some bandwidth. So there are places where you need to turn it off, especially when you are confident that your request most likely will succeed. And so that's one of the other things that usually users do to get more throughput or better latency, rather. Increase default connection limit. And almost everybody hits this. The default connection limit is 2, which means that there can only be 2 outstanding requests to the storage service endpoint at any given time. If you are a production app, most likely you will have more than 2 requests. Set this to 100 or even more, depending on how many requests per second that you serve. So the more the better, basically, because it's not like it's going to use all those service point managers or other service point connections, but it's going to create the connection only if there is none available at any given point in time. So set the default connection limit to greater than 2 for sure if you're a production app. Take advantage of .NET 4.5 GC. This is another kind of pain point that a lot of application developers are facing in terms of where they haven't turned on the right set of GC and they have a lot of memory allocations. And what we see is the app slowdown as such because of .NET GC. The GC performance has greatly improved, especially in 4.5. There's a background GC which does not stall your threads as much as what the previous GC types used to. And so turning this on would help you kind of get better performance as such. And almost all these problems can be figured out if you go to your storage analytics, and we'll get to that in a little bit. So scalability targets for a storage account. An account, especially if it's created after June 7, 2012, an account has some limits as such. From capacity perspective, it can contain up to 200 terabytes of data. From transactions, it can have about 20,000 transactions per second. And from bandwidth, depending on whether you're using geo-redundant or local redundant storage, you can get an ingress from up to 5 gigabits per second. And if you've turned local redundant, opted for local redundant storage, you can get up to 10 gigabits per second. From egress perspective, it's 10 gigabits or 15 gigabits per second. So knowing these storage limits is very important in figuring out what your requirements are for your application, and that kind of drives you to kind of creating more storage accounts if you need to go above the scalability limit as such. Then a given partition also has a scalability target. As Andy went over the architecture as such, each partition is served by a single partition server. A partition server can serve many partitions, but each physical partition is served just by a single partition server. And so it has some scalability limits as such. And these are, again, limits for all accounts that have been created after June 7, 2012. A single queue, the partition key is account name plus queue name. So a single queue is a single partition today. And it can do up to 2,000 messages per second. A single table partition is account name, table name, and partition key value. And it can do up to 2,000 entities per second. And again, it's entities per second and not requests per second. So if you have a batch which is doing 100 entities, it adds up to that particular limit if you're using a single partition or even for your storage account as such. We always talk in terms of entities. Getting to scans, for example, that is, again, expensive because it is not the entities that we return. It's the entities that we need to actually look up on the service end that counts towards your targets as such. A single blob, a single table partition is basically account name, table name, and partition key. So you have this option of choosing what the partition key value is, and depending on your scale target as such, you can choose different kind of partition key values as such, and we'll go over in the table best practice. A single blob is a single partition today, and so it's account name, container name, and the blob name, and all its snapshots. All of them belong to the same partition, and it can serve up to 60 megabits per second. So getting into general Windows Azure storage best practices, in terms of storage accounts as such. Locate your storage account as close to as to your users as such. In case you need to distribute a lot of content to your storage account, to your customers as such, then what you would do is put a CDN behind your storage account so that the CDN can distribute the content to different geographical regions as such. The other thing to understand is your account scalability targets, right? So you get to know whether you need multiple storage accounts, and again, how do you distribute these storage accounts across regions as such. The other best practice is cache critical data sets as such. At the end of the day, it's a distributed system, and the best way to provide higher reliability or higher availability is to use some caching on your end. So wherever possible, use a caching mechanism to kind of fall back on in case storage does not respond to your reads as such. And of course, you can always use read-only from secondary to get more higher availability. Distribute the load over many partitions and avoid spikes. And what we call as append-only pattern, especially. And we will go across, the next slide kind of covers in animations as to what it means when it gets to append-only pattern. But the fact that these partitions are spread across and we can load balance. If you remember the slide that Andy covered, where a partition was overwhelmed with requests, what the master did is to split that range into two ranges and then split them out, place them in different partition servers so that they can scale. And so this can happen only if you distribute your requests across this range of your partition keys. So if you focus on a given set of partition keys, there's not much you can get. There's only so much scale you can achieve if you do that. So it's distribution of your traffic across the range. So we always mention what to kind of avoid append and prepend patterns. And to kind of get more a look at what an append pattern or prepend pattern means, let's look at this particular example where I've taken a table, and it has an account name and table name and partition key and row key, right? And so I have different partition keys. My table name is location out here. And assume that this is all served in one partition server to begin with, right? It's a range-based partitioning system, and so it's all served by one partition server. As requests come in, if the partition server is overwhelmed with risk requests, then what the master does is figure out what a good split range is. It's not necessarily midway through, but what keys are being used. And then it'll select a split range as such, where it's going to now divide this particular range into two, Alaska to Florida, and then Georgia through Washington. So you're going to have these two ranges. And once again, if the traffic continues to grow against the second one, it's going to split again. Now, if your traffic, assume that your traffic is sorted alphabetically on your partition key, right? So you start with Alaska, then go through the next state, and it's kind of sorted as such. This leads to an append pattern where your traffic always goes to this last partition range that we've just created, because your traffic kind of, once we've kind of split it and moved it across, you would move to the next partition key, and it invariably falls in the last segment of the partition range. So an append and prepend pattern is basically where your traffic pattern is following the sorted order of your partition keys. And so avoiding that would actually lead you to get better throughput as such. Otherwise, you always go to the same partition server for all your requests. A common thing to do is to kind of prefix or suffix with date ranges and things like that, your ticks, tick count. All these generally lead to an append or prepend patterns. So there's some way of kind of getting away with kind of making sure that you can distribute by using some hash distribution would be good. This problem is not specific to Windows Azure Storage as such. It is with any range-based partitioning system. And so we follow range-based partitioning system because now what you could do on your end is, if you really want to scale out, you can hash your partition key, but also get this locality benefit where you can list your objects efficiently as such. And that's the reason why we follow range-based partitioning system, so we can provide listing functionality for our users. Continuing with the best practices, obviously use HTTPS. I think at least this is made into at least four or five different slides. And so hopefully that tells you how important it is to kind of use HTTPS, especially if you're dealing with data that needs to be secure. Optimize what you send and receive. It's kind of intuitive out there, it's obvious. But what can you do to kind of reduce the data that you send or receive over the wire? One of the things for blobs, for example, you can use range reads to only read the data that you want to consume, or have efficient continuation in case of failures, rather than re-downloading this entire 200 gigabyte blob or 1 terabyte page blob. You can use these range reads to kind of just continue from where you failed. And most of the browsers already do that today. And so this is kind of helpful for kind of reducing the traffic. In places where you're only interested in metadata, issue head requests rather than getting the content. And use your metadata while listing. You can use this metadata again to filter out which blobs you want and things like that. With respect to tables, we released JSON in October. And this almost provides you about up to 70% reduction in your bandwidth. So JSON has multiple types in OData. You can have no metadata, minimal metadata, and full metadata. No metadata, obviously, as the name says, is the best in terms of conserving the bytes that it kind of sends across the wire. Upsert is another location. Wherever you want to kind of insert if it doesn't exist or update if it exists, you can use the upsert command rather than issuing two requests and then on a failure doing the update or insert vice versa. So you can always use the upsert command. Use the merge command. A merge is really useful where you don't have to send the entire row. Assume your entire row is about 8K, for example, and you want to just update a Boolean. You don't have to send all the properties. You can use merge to just send the properties that you want to update. Use projection, because if you, for a given scenario, if you don't want all your 8K worth of properties, you can only get the properties that you need, and use projection. You can, it's basically select, instead of doing a select star, you're selecting only the properties that you want. issue point queries rather than scans. And again, it cannot be stressed enough where scans are really detrimental to performance. We are not saying do not do scans, but if you're doing scans and expecting a lot of performance out of it, that's not going to happen just because of the way the scans work as such. We are a lookup-based table, and we are most efficient for point lookups. With respect to queue, you can always update messages to kind of save the state rather than going back and processing the entire message again. In the process workflow, you can always resume from where you failed or updated. And also use appropriate batch size while retrieving messages. You can use queue count to kind of scale out. You can use also the DQ count to figure out if you need to increase the visibility time when you're dequeuing a message and things like that. So you can obviously use all these things to kind of scale better. Control parallelism at the application layer. That's one of the things where if you're running a web application as such, and you're getting these requests from customers you need to make sure that you're controlling how many requests that you're sending, and you have sufficient threads to actually get the callbacks from your network calls as such. So you need to make sure it's bounded as such and not unbounded, because you could get throttled if you let all the traffic in without any metering as such. And if at all you do that, you need to have efficient back-off policies in your retries. So almost everything that I mentioned where it could be a problem starting from the .NET connections to reduce the bandwidth used and things like that, almost all of this can be analyzed using Windows Storage Analytics. So you can enable storage analytics on your storage account. And this can also be done either through Portal or we have our client libraries, or if you are one of the REST aficionados, then you can always use REST to kind of send the request as such. So this enables your clients to kind of self-diagnose all the problems that you may be facing in your application. And sometimes you may not even be knowing that most of your requests are failing with expected failures. For example, if you keep creating a container on a price zero scenario in your web app, and the container is already created, you might be failing that for every request that comes in. So you can save a lot of these round trips, because at the end of the day, you want to consume as less CPU, as less bandwidth, as less transactions per second as possible. And analytics kind of enables this through metering and logging. And the common question that we get asked is, how does it impact my application as such? It does not impact your application, because it's in a different namespace. It's only when you read it for your own consumption, that's in your scalability target limits, but generation of analytics is not going to impact, because it's a different namespace. And of course, you can always provide a retention policy on this if you're concerned with the space consumption of logging or metrics. Metrics usually stable data, it doesn't consume much space. It's the logging that can consume space depending on how many requests per second that you do. And so you can always turn on retention policy so that it's automatically garbage collected. So a quick demo on Windows Azure Storage Analytics. I have this particular Java program that I've written, which kind of downloads all the blobs. And if you remember in the previous demo, we said that every storage request can take client request IDs. This client request ID is kind of tagging it, and it gets into your logs. So you can have this end-to-end tracing from your application, starting from your application to the storage logs as such. So you can figure out if a request made in, what was the result, how long did it take on the server, how long did it take over the network, and things like that. If you start placing these request IDs and you log it on the application end, and then you turn on logging, obviously, to get your storage logs with that particular client request ID. Out here, what I've done is I've written an app which basically sets the client request ID to a region name, a username. I have many users that are using this application. And then, of course, or a client request, a GUID as such, that enables me to have this end-to-end tracing. with these three pieces of information, I've just put in the CSV format as such and made that the client request ID. Now, what this enables me to do is run these analysis on top of the logs, which says which region, what is the average throughput for the region or average request size for the region, what is the end-to-end latency for the region, or I can also do that by user. Because I have the user information there, I can pivot all this information on based on that user to figure out how many requests did the user send, what is his success percentage, what is his average latency, and things like that. And also the request pattern. Are there many spikes for this particular user? And a lot of these things that I can figure out from the logs. And the reason I've used logs out here rather than metrics is metrics does not give you this information of client request ID. So metrics is for your storage account, it's aggregated data set. Whereas log, actually every request that makes through to the storage service and it's authenticated makes it into your logs. And so I'm just going to run this particular piece of data. And we'll go over this particular Java application as such to figure out what's going to happen. And it spit out a lot of these numbers. I'm going to show the same set of numbers on Excel, basically. So I've prepackaged it, and I've imported the CSV format into Excel. If you want to know how your logs look, for example, this is how the logs would look. So this is your request. This is a version. This is the timestamp when the request made in. And let me just use zoom it so that people can see it. So as you see here, it has what request was there, what was the status code, what was the HTTP status that was returned, request size, request header, what kind of authentication. It was authenticated request, and it tells you your account name. In fact, it tells you your URL and all that stuff out here. In addition, it also gives you your request ID. For example, out here, what I've done is this was used for my read-only from secondary. I had, if you remember, I had RAGRS and then a comma separated with a client request GUID. And so this has made it in. So for example, if a request doesn't make it to a primary, I can at least come here and figure out if the request succeeded on the server or it never made to storage service as such if it is missing out here. And so these are various things that we can obviously do in terms of analyzing your logs as such. Going back to Excel, and I'm going to just zoom in here once I get to the right. So I have this logs out here. This is my region. This is my customer name. And I have various, obviously, regions out here in US, and some have provided city names, some have provided country and things of that, right? And so I have all this information. I have HTTP status code, end-to-end latency. All this has been retrieved from the logs as such, right? And what I can now do is I can pivot this information on the column that I'm interested or the data that I'm interested. So in case I'm interested in with respect to the customer names and how they're using, I can figure out, okay, what's the customer name? The response packet size is zero, so most likely they're all doing the put request and not get requests. There's this one user who's doing some get requests. And I can also do it by the API. I can also pivot by APIs if I was interested. Out here, it's the latency. I see that the server latencies are all well below 10 milliseconds out here for this particular data size. And the out here, it's just telling me what the sum of response packet sizes are and things like that. It gives you the max server latency. So all this information can be retrieved from your analytics log. And this is the particular Java program that does it. What it takes is basically which file, CSV file, it should dump all the data into. It takes in your connection string. And then you can also provide it a prefix if you're only interested in a given time range. When I ran the program, I didn't provide it a time range. I wanted to go over all the logs that it has and do this analysis as such. It will be wise to actually provide a time range in a practical purpose, but I don't have that many requests, so I just went and processed all the logs as such. And what once you give this prefix as such, what happens is it's going to start downloading the files using the Java storage client library. It's going to create the account. It's going to create the blob client container. It's very similar to the .NET library as such. All our libraries that we've been developing, we want to have the same look and feel in terms of API set. Obviously, it has to give you the feel of Java language. It uses the Java best practices. But in terms of the API set, it's all the same that we want to start providing. So if you can upload a blob in .NET, we want to provide the same in Java too, obviously. So this, given a prefix, it's going to start downloading. It's going to list all the blobs using the list API, which takes a prefix. And so it's going to get all the blob names. And then each blob, it's going to go and start parsing. And let me just get to the parsing piece. So this is where it's going to start parsing all your requests into the format that I need. So it's going to take each individual field out, and then it's going to start parsing that data out and then printing it into the file and also into a buffer, which can be dumped into a log file. And so this is kind of the Java program that I just ran out here. This is the logs downloader. And of course, you have stats, which is creating all the stats pivots that it needs to. If you saw in the command line, it spit out a lot of these numbers in terms of mean, average, and things like that. So it's just going to calculate these based on the request that it gets. Today, it's pivoting based on the customer name and region, which I was interested in, and which I'm populating in all the request headers. And so that's the analytics demo. One of the things that I wanted to cover going back to this is how do you build resilient systems as such? Obviously, we covered reliant caching. It is really important to figure how to use the caching layer to kind of get higher availability as such, or even higher transactions per second than what a storage account can give or a partition can give. Use storage analytics to learn about your usage, understand the limits of a single storage account and partition. We went over that. Avoid unnecessary round trips. Continuously monitor your logs for anomalies. For example, you can, if you're given out a shared access signature, you can always figure out if it's being accessed the way you thought it was being accessed through your logs. So going and looking at your logs and getting this information out of your logs by using HD Insight or whatever it is out there that allows you to do some map reduce over these logs will be beneficial for your system as such. And of course, efficient retries. For example, if you're using a background job, use exponential backoff. If you're using websites, obviously exponential backoff is not an healthy backoff strategy for a website because your user is not going to wait for you that long. So use a constant backoff depending on what your SLA is to the customer and have a fast failure path. But in the background, you can always go and populate your cache, for example. So caching is a great example where a lot of websites internally built on top of Windows Azure Storage are using to serve a lot of these requests in case storage does not return on time. And of course, use secondary for higher availability. Getting to blob service best practices as such, one of the first things that I would like to mention is avoid small range reads on large size blocks. For example, if you are uploading a blob that needs to be streamed through some media player, most of the media players ask for small chunks, right? A second chunk of video or 2 seconds chunk of video, and they keep streaming this in range and buffering it. And so if you have uploaded the blob, let's say with 4 megabytes and then doing small reads, that's not going to be efficient as such. So make sure that your read sizes based on what you have matches kind of what you've put out there for your block sizes as such. How do I upload one of the common questions we get is how do I upload this entire folder that I have the fastest to the cloud? the best way is to upload multiple blobs simultaneously. Rather than using the concurrent workers to upload a single blob using block upload, you can actually upload these multiple blobs simultaneously. Of course, being wary about the bandwidth that you're consuming, and then upload these multiple blobs to the storage account. That gives you the best throughput as such. There's another thing too, Windows Azure Import Export. Use that if you have tons of data that needs to be put into storage. And it's in preview mode, and you can always go to the portal and submit a request for import-export tokens. How do I upload a single blob the fastest? So it's more latency perspective. The fastest way is to do parallel block upload as such. But remember that your scalability target is 60 megabytes per second. It can go up to 60 megabytes per second. And so if you want faster than that, you almost have to design a solution where you're uploading multiple blobs. There are two pieces of information always, concurrency and parallelism, and this is what we covered out here. Concurrency is multiple workers uploading different blobs. Remember, a blob is a partition key, so logically it'll go to different partitions, different logical partitions, and our load balancer can better spread or split these partitions to match your throughput needs. Parallelism, which is using multiple threads to upload blocks in parallel. So just to give you a feel for what it means when you use concurrency or parallelism. Concurrency is multiple blobs, parallelism is multiple threads for a single blob. If you use one thread to upload one single blob, you get about 13.2 megabytes per second. If you use one blob but you parallelly upload it, you get up to about 50 megabytes per second or 51 megabytes per second. However, if you're uploading multiple blobs, using 30 concurrent threads, so your 30 blobs that you're uploading, you can get up to 96 megabytes per second. And this is all, this actually was an Excel VM, which is saturating the single Excel VM. It's been run on a single VM. So why is C1, P1 actually so drastically different or slower from C1, P30 or C30, P1? Obviously, single TCP connection is bound by some delays as such. It's bound by your RTT and rate control as such. So creating these multiple connections actually give you a better chance to upload and download faster. And again, P30, C30 was almost twice as fast. It gets back to the fact that if you're hitting multiple blobs, it's better for Windows Azure Storage as such, where it can load balance. While downloading similarly, concurrency one, parallel one, I can get up to 96 megabytes per second. But if I try to download various blobs at the same time, obviously I can go higher. With respect to table service best practice, use JSON over AtomPub, up to 70% reduction in bandwidth, and we'll quickly see that. Critical queries, select partition key. Basically, these critical queries in your application is what you'll have to start thinking about so that you can select your partition key value and row key to avoid these hotspots that we're talking about. Distribute your traffic across the partition range. And table scans are expensive, and so avoiding them at all costs will be good. The reason is because it's the number of entities that we have to do IOs on that counts towards your scale limits, and so they're pretty expensive. Batch, same partition key for entities that need to be updated together, need to have the same partition key value. And so if in your schema model as such, if you have transaction requirements as such, most likely you will put these entities in the same partition key. Remember, Windows Azure Table is a NoSQL store, so it's schemaless. You can store multiple types in the table. And we provide a single index today, which is partition key and row key, so you can concatenate different columns as such to create a bigger index, with prefix being the most important in that particular index. With respect to entity locality, the sort order is dependent on your partition key, row key combination because that's your clustered index. And so remember that in terms of when you're storing your data. And of course, use this table service client layer, which was released in 2.1, and we are up to a 3.0 release at this point. It provides a dramatic performance improvement, and also it has JSON by default for the 3.0 library. So quick demo as such. I'm going to remove all these things here. because I want to just concentrate on the first four. I'm going to zoom in a given second. So here is a query that I did on my table, and I've used four different formats. I've used AtomPub, I've used JSON full metadata, I've used JSON minimal metadata, and JSON no metadata. If you see, there's almost 70% up to, I think it's about 67% of savings if you use no metadata as against AtomPub. But JSON in particular has been providing lower bandwidth usage as such, and better latency too, because XML processing is pretty expensive compared to JSON processing. Let's just go over these requests as such. So if you go out here and look at this particular accept application JSON, OData equal to minimal metadata for the first request, which is 132K. This OData format as such is what can be changed to minimal, no metadata, and other things out there, like Adam, no metadata, full metadata, and minimal metadata. If you go for this, and this one does not have any format requested, so by default it is sending AtomPub, or you can request for AtomPub in a similar accept format. So this is just to kind of give you a feel for how fast JSON can be just because of the amount of bytes transferred over the network and also the processing speed of JSON. With respect to queue, make message processing idempotent. Messages become visible if client worker fails to delete messages. So you need to make sure that even if you see the message again, you can be idempotent. And one way to do that is storing update messages or just making the process flow a little more idempotent as such. Benefit from update messages. Store your state so that you don't have to redo your process flow. Message count uses to scale your workers. DQ count uses to identify poison messages so that you know if this message is being, your processor cannot handle this message, and that's why your queue is being built. Large messages, you can store up to 64K messages in blob in queue messages. But if you want to store larger, you can always store that in blob and then store that index in blob so that you can delete it at the end once the blob is processed. So you can get better throughput as such by storing a lot of these, batching a lot of these messages into blob. And of course, use multiple queues. Remember, a queue is a single partition. So use multiple queues to just get better throughput. With respect to, we just wanted to quickly cover some common scenarios as such. Where should I store my logs and other things? And we'll just go through all these common scenarios that we've been asked quite a lot internally and externally within Microsoft. Where should my logs go, blobs or tables? Well, verbose logs are best placed in blobs because most of the time verbose logs are retrieved in chunks. So you're not doing a scan per se, but you're retrieving the whole chunk of data. And logs are used more for diagnostic purpose, and you would say, I want logs from maybe 10 a.m. to 10.05 a.m., and you want this chunk of logs as such. And blobs are much more easier to process. Table data is OData protocol, so it has a lot of these data massaging that happens, which bloats up the data space, compared to blobs, which can remain raw. You can also compress it and store your blobs as such. And binary format doesn't have to be encoded or anything, which needs to if you're storing it in tables. So use blobs for storing your verbose logs. However, there are these alerts or errors that you may have in your system. You can queue them in a system so that you get more direct access and it's searchable and things like that. So queue this alerting, and this alert can now go be processed almost in real time if you're using some queuing mechanism. And with respect to verbose logs, obviously you can use a single writer per role instance and use buffer this data and then keep writing these blocks based on some size and time-based limits. And then when it gets to a certain size, the blob gets to a certain size, you can commit the blob. So this kind of gives you an efficient way and from cost and from performance perspective. The other question we get asked is, how many storage accounts would I need? Well, understand the limits of a storage account, and you obviously know your application the best as to what throughput you require from your storage account as such. And so creating only the number of storage accounts that you may need for the near future would be the best way to proceed. But once you do that, how do you grow, right? There are multiple ways of growing your storage account. Assume that you are servicing your users as such. And if the users all have a limit, you can do the math and figure out how many storage accounts can, or rather, how many of your users can fit in a storage account, and then have this pool of storage accounts. And so when the pool gets exhausted, you can start creating new storage accounts for your new users. So that would be your option one, where you use this map of your username to a given storage account. There's a second scenario out there where you want these user data is not bounded. They may grow. Certain users may grow by far a lot more than certain other users. In this case, what you can do is you can restrict that user to use certain containers and put some restriction on that container. And now you can map the username container to your storage account so you can keep growing. So whenever he reaches a limit, you can start creating new containers as such and keep growing your pool of storage accounts in that fashion. There is also hash-based partitioning system, a consistent hash-based partitioning system that you can use where you use a consistent hashing mechanism to figure out which storage account you need to go to. The downside is when you add more storage accounts, you need a way of migrating your users as such. Certain portion of your users need to be migrated. So that's something which usually applications find it more tough to handle. So using some lookup-based seems to be more easy, or at least more popular amongst most applications that are doing this today. What is the best way for users to upload, download data from storage? We have released cores, and so now what you can do is have your web app directly communicate to storage as such through the browser. So your web app will use cores. Your web app will use a storage account where cores is enabled, and then when you serve this web page as such, you will provide a SAS token for that resource that needs to be uploaded or downloaded so that the browser being used by the user directly interacts with storage and you're not acting as a proxy. Why is this better? Less number of hops, and also your application does not have to scale as much as what storage does today. And so this provides the best way to kind of scale your application. What is the best way to pre-process resources being uploaded? There are a lot of scenarios today where you need encoding of images or compression of files and things like that, where you want to store the compressed file, not the raw file, and you want to give this as a value-added service. Rather than now, again, pre-processing in your proxy service, what you could do is store it in a temporary location in the blob storage, and you have two options again. You can either use this temporary location and list the blobs, but listing is again scanning. Or better yet, if you have the option of putting this index into a queue message and then after that uploading this blob and this queue message processing taking care of if the blob fails and things like that, that's a better way where you're not scanning, you're not doing this listing of blobs as such, and you're directly, this queue message is providing this direct interaction of what needs to be done, whether it is image processing or compression or whatever it needs to do. It can do that, copy the encoded blob or image to the right location, and then delete it. Delete the temp location blob, and then delete your message. So you can do this pre-processing as such in a very efficient manner. And so, yeah, that's about it.
So now we're going to take an opportunity to go through some of the questions that have been posted during the talk, and I'll ask some of them, and Jay will answer some, and I'll answer some, since I've been looking at them when he's been talking just now. So the first question is about how to transfer data from one subscription to another or from one storage account to another. So if you go to our team blog, Windows Azure Storage team blog, you can just search that on the internet, then There's a tool on there called AZ Copy, which will allow you to copy data between blobs or submit a copy, and it will copy it from one storage account to another storage account within that region or across regions, and you can use that for blobs. Do you have a suggestion, Jay, for tables?
Yeah, for tables, that's something which we're looking at how to solve it. And what we would be doing, what the proposed solution until we have a solution out there is to kind of suck all the table data into blobs, store it in Windows Azure Storage, and then through your compute role, suck the blob back. In fact, you can maintain it in JSON format, so now it's an easy transfer back and forth. So that would be the easiest way to kind of transfer it.
And next question is about geo replication and about how long it would take us if we did have a disaster in one region before we would fail over to the other region. What's the maximum amount of time that would take? And so do you want to go for that one?
Sure. There's no max time per se as such. Like Andy actually mentioned it in his talk. If we can get that data back again on the primary location, we will strive to get that back. The reason is because not many apps deal with eventual consistency and things like that. And if they don't want to failover, if we can get the data back on the primary, they don't want to do that. Because today, the failover is at the stamp level as such, where we have to failover the entire stamp. It's not account-based failover. We do have a roadmap, and I think Brad Calder in his PDC talk, in the build talk, did mention that we are going to have things like the ability for users to control their failover so they can practice this, or they can also push that button if they can deal with eventual consistency. So, yeah.
And we have one more geo question, which talked about if you have a failover and we start writing to the secondary, then eventually will that data changes be made back to the primary? So the idea of a failover is that that secondary becomes the primary, and then in theory, if that happened, we would have that data center and get it back up, and that would become the secondary, and then those changes would be replicated back once that data center came back up. But that old data that was on the old primary, the first primary, would be gone at that point, essentially, that hadn't been geo-replicated. So there's another interesting question that I'm going to kind of translate it from how it was written. But in the case, and I'll let Jay answer it after I ask it. So in the case where somebody is making a change to their software, like they've created a version A and they've created some tables with some schemas, right? And they've updated their schema, they've got the schema going. And they want to make a change to their software, to their client, and add like a new row or a schema change. How is it that they can do that in a way that keeps using their old data and keep it working, but also have the new data work?
Right. So this is almost with, there are multiple approaches. One common approach is to use a two-phase, where you push your software that's not going to write that new property, but it understands what that property means. So if it sees that property, it's going to write it, but if it doesn't see, it's not, right? And then you have this kind of either a config change where it says, okay, now you can, all these services have been upgraded across all the upgrade domains and across all the locations, and now you can start writing this property so that everybody understands. So that's one common approach that people have used. The other way of doing that is also to use merge. So if you use merge, for example, an application that does not know about this property is not going to lose it if it updates it. Only when you use replace is it going to lose it. And so if you use merge, that property which some other service has written will still maintain that property. And so you can use merge to kind of maintain those two schemas together.
Great. Another question that we have is about what we call the global namespace. So let me redefine what we mean by global namespace. So what we mean is every blob or table or queue within our storage service has a name that you can use anywhere in the world to reference that particular blob in that particular stamp in that particular storage account. So that doesn't mean that, which is the opposite question, is how do you do this type of application where you want to have one name for a content that's in lots of different places, so that the data would be as close to the user as possible. And that's where we start talking about a CDN, which is a CDN is the opposite. So we have this global namespace where one piece of data is in one place and you reference it and you have to go and talk to it wherever it is. Whereas a CDN would provide the opposite, where you have the same data spread over lots of places. So we provide a global namespace, not a CDN.
Right.
The next question along here, is charging. So all that. Jay, answer this. Do we charge for storage based on the consumption or the provisioned amount of data?
It's consumption today. So you charge based on your consumption model.
That was a really quick question. The next question is actually very appropriate because it was one of the things we want to talk about. Will Jay's Java apps and samples be available for download? And
yes. After this? I think we started off by saying that we need some LCA approval for putting any source code out there on the website. And so what we're going to do is get the LCA approval, go through all the formalities, and then we'll place the code link on our Windows Azure Storage Team blog. And also, I'll tweet about it too. So,
perfect. So the next question is, can I define my own variables for analytics? And even though Jay tried to explain it last time, I'll take a stab at this one. So what we do in analytics is we have a schema that's a fixed schema that reports a bunch of essentially columns within the schema. So we tell you about the URL for the request and how long it took us to process it and how long it spent going over the internet and variety of information. And then we have a column that's the user request, or is the request ID is what mm-hmm. we're calling that. And so in your client library, when you're calling to us, you can specify whatever request ID you want. And so what Jay had done in his demo is he had actually put a couple of columns in there with commas separated between them so that he could have a variety of information in that client request, and then he could query that when he pulls down the analytics and parse it out and actually have multiple information or multiple additional information in addition to what we provide in the storage analytics. So the answer to the question is you essentially can define your own variables if you tuck it all into this request ID field.
Right. The other thing which I want to mention, there is two request IDs out there, one which server provides and one which client provides. The best practice, again, to reiterate, would be for your application to log the client request ID, and then in the analytics logs, you get both the service request ID and the client request ID. So you can have this end-to-end tracing, per se, with analytic logs.
Okay, and so we have one more question, which is, how does Azure achieve scalability when only the index is partitioned and distributed, but the data is not? And so I'll go ahead and take that one.
Yes.
So the index and the data are both partitioned separately, independently, in the different levels of our architecture. And so in the partition layer, where the index is partitioned, that's spread out and load balanced. And then in the distributed file system layer, the lower levels, that data is also spread out independently of the other ones. So we're able to achieve scalability and independence of those two layers of the data and the index in order to keep our scalability. With that, we're out of questions. So we, again, will remind you that there's this Windows Azure Storage Team blog that has lots of information, a variety of samples and demos and things that we've done over the years. And we continually are posting new information there, and we'll put Jay's demos up there eventually. We want to thank you for coming and listening to us today. It's been a pleasure to tell you all about Windows Azure Storage. And we want to remind you that there was a change in the schedule. The next presenter, Scott Hanselman, is unable to make it this afternoon, and so we're going to wind up today's presentation a little bit early. But there will be more tomorrow on schedule. Hopefully no one else is sick.
Thanks a lot.
Yes, thank you.